From Loyola University Chicago School of Law and WLUW, this is The Podvocate. We're law students exploring the vanguard of the legal world with experts from our backyard and beyond. Subscribe to The Podvocate wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about this episode and our guests, please visit our website at thepodvocate.com and check out our social media pages. Welcome back to The Podvocate. I'm Casey Callahan. Today, I'm venturing into something new. Well, it's not necessarily new for The Podvocate, but it's something new for me. Today, I'm doing a teaching episode, something that our editors-in-chief are encouraging all of us to try. And this is hopefully going to set up a couple of interviews I have coming later in the semester. A lot of my episodes previously have focused on the criminal legal system and all of its branches. Some of these have included the restorative justice community courts, the process of preparing mitigation for sentencing, federal reentry courts, and the family regulation system, or more commonly known, the child welfare system. Today, I'm going to focus on the collateral consequences of a criminal conviction. Collateral consequences of a criminal conviction are defined as legal sanctions and restrictions imposed upon people because of their criminal record. Now, these are distinct from a sentence. Collateral consequences are a web of laws and regulations that prevent people with convictions from accessing aspects of life that other citizens can, even when their sentence is finished. For example, someone may plead guilty to a particular felony offense. And as a reminder, a felony offense is an offense that can be sentenced to at least a year, but does not have to be sentenced to a year in custody. So back to this example. Someone may plead guilty to a particular felony offense and be sentenced to 3 years probation. No prison time. After those 3 years, that sentence is over. But that individual may still be denied the right to vote, may be denied access to public benefits, like SNAP benefits, food stamps, may be denied the right to adoption, and may be denied licensure for certain jobs. Collateral consequences are a web of laws and regulations put forth by various regulatory bodies and lawmaking bodies. They can be confusing for even legal professionals to navigate, especially legal professionals who are already overwhelmed. Moreover, while defendants are entitled to counsel on the consequences of their criminal conviction regarding what the sentence could look like and the conviction's impacts on immigration status, defendants are generally not entitled as a matter of due process to be warned of the collateral consequences that may come into play after accepting a plea or upon conviction. So, what are some examples of collateral consequences? Well, you may know a few of the most common or well-understood ones. There's the prohibition on gun possession for people who are convicted of felonies. There's a funnily named article I came across in my research called "Why Can't Martha Stewart Own a Gun?" Anyone with a felony conviction can be prohibited from accessing or being in possession excuse, not accessing, but being in possession of a gun. Even someone like Martha Stewart, who was only convicted of a white collar offense. There's the revocation of a driver's license after a DUI, another one people may know or assume exists. And then there's registration with local government bodies after being convicted of what is considered a sex crime. But some other examples include housing. Federal law has a mandatory ban on access to public housing for people with certain types of convictions. And crucially, even entire households may be evicted based on the arrest or criminal conviction of just one household member. This poses a concern for folks re-entering to society after serving a sentence. If their family and all of their community support lives in public housing, they cannot go live with them lest they risk eviction for themselves and their family. And yet they too may be prohibited from accessing public housing, depending on the type of conviction that they have. Moreover, a majority of states have a ban on persons with felony drug convictions accessing public assistance like SNAP or food stamps. And people with certain criminal convictions may also be ineligible from accessing government assistance for higher education. These consequences can be automatic, discretionary, or may be found by employers or other agencies through a background check, where the person authorized to do the background check is able to review an individual's entire criminal record. Some examples of specific laws in Washington state, a relative child may not be placed with a relative or member of a convicted individual's household. There's been a lot of movement, as I discussed in my family regulation system episode, pushing towards keeping children in foster care with their family members. But if that family member has a conviction in the state of Washington, they may be prohibited from having that child live with them. In Arkansas, no individual found guilty of a felony which included the intent to manufacture or distribute a substance, a controlled substance, can access SNAP benefits. So, what can an attorney do? How can we fully and inform individuals who are faced with a criminal conviction about the true consequences of that plea or that conviction? Well, the National Inventory of Collateral Consequences of Criminal Convictions put together a bench book, a judicial bench book, to help educate judges on the web of collateral consequences that they can possibly take into consideration during their sentencing or admonish defendants before they consider a plea. They also put together a database which attorneys or judges or the individual facing the conviction can access to try to see what the web of consequences they may face are. Here's an example of someone accessing the database. A prosecutor and a defense lawyer in Virginia are negotiating a plea after the defendant was in a bar fight. The prosecutor wants a plea to a misdemeanor assault. But the defendant has been working for an enrolled Medicare provider for 8 years, and they have a great employment record. The defendant's number one concern, other than the sentence he might receive if he's convicted, is keeping his job. Other defendants in other cases similar to this might be concerned about losing housing or becoming ineligible for certain benefits like educational grants or child custody. So the prosecutor and the defense lawyer during the negotiations go to the NICCC website to examine the collateral consequences of a plea to a misdemeanor assault. Once on the site, they select the option crimes of violence, including person offenses, as a misdemeanor assault is. The results yield a total of 171 collateral consequences in the state of Virginia for a conviction for a crime of violence. Some of these consequences are mandatory and automatic, and some are discretionary. Some are permanent, and others do not indicate whether they are permanent. But immediately, one of the collateral consequences that pops up gets their attention. If the defendant pleads to a misdemeanor assault, the defendant will be disqualified forever to keep his job or ever work for a Medicare provider in Virginia. Now, it's possible that both the prosecutor and the defense counsel will agree that a plea to a misdemeanor assault will result in collateral consequences that are overly harsh. They might decide to consider the misdemeanor of disturbing the peace. So they run another search, and this time they'll click on any misdemeanor. Those results yielded 141 collateral consequences in the state of Virginia. Again, for this defendant, the key question is whether any of these will mandate that the defendant loses his job at the Medicare provider. The lawyers then narrow their search, adding a search term to narrow the results to the mandatory and automatic consequences, rather than including those consequences which are discretionary. And after that, a total of 23 mandatory and automatic co collateral consequences were yielded. Thankfully, none of which would cause the defendant to lose his job. But this search is only limited to Virginia law. There's also options on the website to check for federal collateral consequences, but for the first consideration, because the defendant would have been automatically excluded, they didn't check. now that they're considering disturbing the peace, they checked federal collateral consequences. And thankfully, there were only three relevant federal collateral consequences, and none of them would have prevented the defendant from keeping his job. However, suppose now that the prosecutor is unwilling to back off a charge of misdemeanor assault, and the defense lawyer brings the litany of collateral consequences to the court and asks the court to weigh in on the harshness of the collateral consequences and the utility of the defendant keeping his job. The court could be convinced that the loss of the defendant's job would be an unduly harsh consequence, and it might be able to persuade the court might be able to persuade the prosecutor to change her mind about the charge. I've only worked at the public defender's office a little while, but I saw the results of collateral consequences in the concerns of our clients about where they would live and about losing their job. Many of the concerns stemmed from misdemeanors. Yet, a tool like the NICCC database would have been really helpful. In counseling our clients and in negotiating with prosecutors. And I'll include a link to that in the description today. So, in that scenario, the attorney brings the collateral consequences to the judge, and the judge is made aware and can either consider that during sentencing, if possible, or talk to the prosecutor. In my mass incarceration class last year, we read an opinion, a federal district court opinion, by a judge in Connecticut, Judge Block, who unashamedly considered the collateral consequences and what he called the civil death that the individual he was sentencing was inevitably going to experience after being found guilty. Chevelle Nesbitt was found guilty of the importation of cocaine and possession of cocaine with intent to distribute. And in his opinion, he highlighted the restrictions on employment, the restrictions on her voting rights, and the thwarting of her ultimate goals based on her guilty verdict for her offense. He contended that these collateral consequences were a form of a new civil death that convicted felons now suffer. In a clear and scathing critique of this new civil death, he notes, "Today, a criminal freed from prison has scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a freed slave or black person living in free Mississippi at the height of Jim Crow." And he emphasizes that the very discrimination we have legalized for returned citizens, discrimination in housing, employment, education, public benefits, even jury service, is exactly what we have left in the past. What we believe, excuse me, we have left in the past. Judge Block iterated the frustration he felt with the current, quote, constellation of laws, or as I've been calling it, the web of collateral consequences. And Judge Block acknowledged that though he may see fit a sentence of simply probation, which is what he gave Ms. Nesbeth, someone also might receive a lifetime of unemployment for the same offense. And Judge Block bravely paves the way for other judges to follow suit in their sentencing opinion, viewing his role as not deciding a case based on the law and the facts at hand, but on how his decision will contribute to a greater legal framework. He opines about the breadth of collateral consequences that any potential returning citizen may face, not just simply the ones that Shvel Nesbeth was guaranteed to encounter. In his opinion, he outlines that circuits are split as to whether a judge may permissibly consider collateral consequences, but in his jurisdiction, which was the Second Circuit, they embrace the significance and impact of collateral consequences facing a convicted felon as a permissible thing to consider when deliberating a just punishment. Judge Block notes that this is a particularly important and enlightened view where it impacts a poor and underprivileged defendant. A just punishment will inherently look different for the wealthy and for the poor. He goes one step further, though, and names the responsibility of the defense attorney, prosecutor, and probation department to apprise the court and the defendant of any potential collateral consequences. So the tides are turning. Movement lawyers are arguing about this, so arguing to the court and negotiating with prosecutors to consider the civil death that someone may face. And movement judges are being receptive to those arguments. But real change is going to have to come outside of the criminal legal system. Advocating against regulations in public housing, advocating against regulations from licensure boards, advocating against regulations in SNAP benefits and food stamps, fighting for the re-enfranchisement and the restoration of the right to vote for people in custody and when they've returned. Thank you for taking the time to learn with me about the web of collateral consequences, legal sanctions, and restrictions imposed on people because of their criminal records. And I will include resources in the description if you or any of your colleagues are counseling someone facing a criminal conviction, or if you or any of your colleagues are negotiating a plea. Thank you for joining me. And I'll see you next time, back here on the Podvocate. That's all from us here at the Podvocate. Thanks again for joining us today. Our team wants to hear from you. If there's a topic you want the show to cover, please email us at thepodvocate@gmail.com. Visit our website at thepodvocate.com for more information on this episode and our guests. The Podvocate is produced by WLUW, the student-run independent radio station, broadcasting from the School of Communications at Loyola University Chicago. Our editors-in-chief are Neka Ugu and Andy Vandenbush. Our senior editors are Casey Callahan and Marcus McNeil. Our associate editors are Johannes Alvarez Rivero, Karan Kashel, Maris Medina, and Ben Recht. Special thanks to Associate Director of Student Affairs, Professor Radhika Sutherland, and Dean Stephen Rushen for providing the resources and support to make this show possible. From Loyola University Chicago School of Law, this has been The Podvocate.